The First Step. At the age of 11, Yang Chen had known who she was for a while on an intellectual level, and treated her avatarhood with a child's seriousness at the behest of her elders.
"This is a very important secret, all right? Like Searing's custard recipe. Best not to talk about it until we figure a few more things out."
The involuntary bouts of vivid memories still occurred. The ease with which past avatars slipped into Yang Chen's speech troubled the leaders of the Western Temple. She would eavesdrop on their discussions about her, air-spouting herself under windowsills, hiding behind pillars.
"You know, we keep asking that question, what do we do with her?" she heard Jetson say one day, sharper than she usually was with her elders.
"The answer is, we'll prevent her from hitting her head on the ground, and when the memories are over, we'll carry on. That's what she needs from us, so that's what we'll give her. Nothing more, nothing less." As if Yang Chen needed another reason to worship her older sister. Jetson wasn't related to her by blood, or maybe she was in the manner of fourth or fifth cousins, but it definitely didn't matter. The girl who cut up fruit in a stupid way, but at least gave you the symmetrical pieces, was your sister. The girl who showed you no mercy on the airball court and laughed in your face as she kept you scoreless was your sister. Jetson was either the person who would listen to Yang Chen cry with utmost patience, or the one who'd upset her in the first place. So it made perfect sense that Jetson would guide her through her first attempt at meditating into the spirit world. A guide was an anchor as much as a pathfinder, a calling voice in the darkness.
"Don't have so many expectations," Jetson told a Yang Chen, buzzing with excitement. "Not everyone has the ability to cross between realms. You won't be less or more of an avatar, or an air nomad, or a person, if it doesn't happen."
"If you did it, I can do it."
"If you did it, I need to do it. To become more like you." The older nun rolled her eyes and flicked Yang Chen on the forehead where her arrow point would eventually be. They went topside to the meadows above the cliffs of the Western Air Temple. There was no need to travel all the way to the Eastern Temple, the jumping-off point for many spiritual journeys, when they could try closer to home first. Besides, Jetson scoffed, the extra sanctity of the Eastern Temple was more reputation and less proven truth. In the grass was a meditation circle, a stone slab floor laid level in the earth. Five columns of rock jutted out around the circle, unevenly spaced. They looked like fingers and a thumb. The triple air nomad whorls at their tips, the prints. Yang Chen knew about this place, but had always avoided it.
"It feels like a giant is about to grab me."
"Or let you go," Jetson said. "A hand either opens or closes. But it can't do either of those twice in a row."
Yang Chen never knew how Jetson managed to be so blunt and cryptic at the same time.
The two of them sat in the giant's palm, facing each other.
They weren't alone. Abbess Dagmola and Librarian Searing had come along and relegated themselves to assistants, setting up incense, a wind horn. The abbess herself was going to ring the meditation bell. There was no hesitance by the two much older women in deferring to Jetson as guide. The session began. The smoldering incense was sharp and earthy, like tree resin. Yang Chen could feel the overtones of the horn through her stone seat. She lost count of the bell strikes that both marked time and pointed out its meaninglessness. She suddenly saw a bright glow through her closed eyes, as if she'd been laboring under clouds the whole time. When she opened them, the light was intense, but not blinding. Colors were brighter, as if the elements themselves had been ground in a mortar and then repainted on the backing of the world. Red flowers in the meadow glowed like embers,
Green veins pulsed through canopying leaves the size of house roofs, and the sky was bluer than a cake of solid indigo dye. Yang Chen had performed a feat of avatarhood. It had not happened to her involuntarily. It had not struck her down like thunder between her temples. It had not racked painfully through her limbs to damage the landscape. She'd done it. She'd done it. Her victory. And best of all, her favorite person in the world was right there beside her to share the moment. "Huh," Jetson said in one of her classic understatements. "First try." Yang Chen wanted to laugh and leap a mile into the air, but she would maintain a cool head, just like her guide. "Maybe I only remembered how." "Humility isn't more important than the truth. I think you pulled this off yourself." She thought her heart would burst. Over the hills of the spirit world, a pod of great winged whales, translucent and jelly-like, slowly floated through the sky. Nearby, a bouncing mushroom released a cloud of spores, which turned into twinkling fireflies. She was struck by a question. "What do we do now?" "That's the beauty of it," Jetson said. "We don't do anything. There is no use to the spirit world, and therein lies the great lesson. Here you don't take. You don't anticipate or plan. You don't struggle. You don't worry about value gained and lost. You just exist, like a spirit." A pout of disappointment crossed Yang Chen's lips. "Do we have to exist in this one spot only? Can we at least explore?" Jetson grinned down at her. "Yes. Yes, we can." Yang Chen took her sister's hand and decided there was a chance she might like being the avatar. Voices of the Present. Middlers often had difficulty understanding how quickly one place's fortunes could rise at the expense of another's. In the continuing wake of the Platinum Affair, many of the new arrivals to Bin Er seemed caught off guard by the city's explosive growth, even though they were part of it themselves, swept along by change. Kavik, on the other hand, knew vital locations could shift great distances without warning. Herds moved like water. Schools of fish moved like water. People did, too, when their livelihoods depended on it. And the flow wasn't always peaceful. Currents of human beings could rush too fast into a single pool without an escape, smashing chunks of ice and flotsam to bits. If your boat ever got caught in such a vortex, the key to survival was figuring out how long you had until you suffered the same fate. Kavik wasn't sure how much time Bin Er had left as a whole. But as for himself, right now, he was thinking there were maybe 10-20 minutes before things got ugly. Out of control ugly. He'd been trying to cross the square in the International District when a large crowd, buzzing with hostility, blocked his way. The heavy winter clothing everyone wore to survive along the northern edge of the Earth Kingdom continent made it difficult to squeeze through the cracks. Usually Kavik was on top of these kinds of disruptions. "What's going on?" he asked the people nearby.
"We finally pinned Shang Teyin down," a large man said while peering over the top of the crowd. "He had to leave the walls of his estate at some point. Either he listens to us here and now, or he gets to spend the night holed up in Gidu Shrine."
Kavik swallowed his alarm. "And how did you do that exactly? Teyin's normally hard to find, isn't he?"
"We pooled our money together and paid for an errand runner to copy the shrine's schedule of private reservations," the man said, grinning with satisfaction. "Gotta use the enemy's methods against him. And wouldn't you know it, tonight is the anniversary of Teyin's grandfather's death."
This wasn't going to end well. Teyin was no talk, all stick. The idea that the powerful Shang would interrupt his ancestral rituals appear on the steps of the Gidu shrine and benevolently acknowledge his employee's grievances was misguided at best and dangerous at worst. He needed to get out of here.
"Give that old goat dog the business,"
Kavik said. He turned to leave. A heavy hand landed on his shoulder and spun him back around.
"Stay with us, brother," said the man, staring at him intently. "If the Shangs don't get an earful now and then, they'll pretend we don't exist. Every voice counts."
Newcomers just had to be difficult, didn't they? He was asking Kavik to take a firmer stance, and a boy asking questions could have been in the pocket of Taeyin or another Shang, a spy sent to monitor the crowd. He gave Kavik a jostle, equal parts fraternal and threatening.
"Sorry, but I have to place an order at the apothecary's," Kavik said.
He had his own tasks ahead of him and didn't want to make any new friends.
"At this time of day?"
The grip on him tightened.
"I know it's late," Kavik said quickly, "but Uncle Ping takes his time closing and always lets me get a request in before he goes home."
He watched the story work its way through the man's head. Perhaps he'd overdone it with the details, but the delay alone was enough.
"There he is! There's Taeyin!" came a shout.
When the man turned to look, Kavik slipped out of his grasp and into the crowd. He fought his way through the moving mass, swimming parallel to the riptide, and spared a glance at the shrine. The stone steps of Gidu rose 15 feet into the air, and culminated in a double-roofed hall where the wealthy could pay their respects to their ancestors and leave offerings for the spirits. Shang Taeyin, a slight but hale man of 60, had emerged atop the sacred little island and sneered with distaste down at the people boxing him in.
"Cheat! Fraud! Pay us what you owe us!"
The angry cries seemed to bother Taeyin about as much as falling leaves. He took a deep breath through his nose, and Kavik's heart began racing. That wasn't the face of a man ambushed. That was the expression of a man going on the attack. The Shang signaled with his fingers, and a squad of men poured out of the shrine behind him. Hired toughs, head kickers lying in wait. Whether through bribes, betrayals, or hiring spies of his own, Taeyin had caught wind of the demonstration and prepared his counter moves in advance. The paid muscle descended the steps and slammed into the front ranks of the crowd. The screaming started, and Kavik pulled his hood down as low as it could go. He ducked under elbows and spun on the balls of his feet and shoved people from behind when he had to, until he reached the edge of the square. He tried to avoid looking back. The fighting would only get so bad. Yes, there would be fists thrown, and he assumed Taeyin's goons probably had saps and kashes hidden up their sleeves. But that would be the extent of it. Any bending would be just for bruises. No one in Bin Er, Shang or otherwise, wanted to bring Earth Kingdom law into the city by committing a capital offense. The whole incident had nothing to do with him. Never mind that Kavik was the errand runner who'd broken into Gidu Shrine a week ago to copy the reservation list in the first place. If he hadn't taken the job, it would have gone to someone else.
"It'll be all right," he told himself over the chorus of violence behind him.
Only 2 blocks away from the square, there was peace. No disturbances, no signs of fighting. Just the muffled quiet of the day winding down. In Bin Er, a short walk could land you in another realm entirely. Kavik passed men and women filing out of shipping offices into the street. They looked neither to the right nor the left at the empty stands that served only midday meals, the closed shops providing paper and brushes sold by the bale, the auction houses where the prices of cloth and porcelain across the four nations were decided. Only straight ahead, to their beds. They'd learn about the scuffle in the square, and then they'd simply go around it. The same way you'd take a different route to avoid an overturned wagon. An inconvenient ruckus, to be certain. one that happened more frequently these days in Bin-Ur. But that was the cost of doing business, no? Kavik turned off the main street into an alleyway. He hadn't known who the buyer of the shrine information was going to be. That was the whole point of using a broker like Chiu, to keep both sides of a deal anonymous. Kavik had assumed it was simply another Shang who wanted an edge over their rival, the way most of the business for errand runners in Bin-Ur was generated. He reached the house he was going to break into. The blue manse sat at the very edge of Shang territory. Beyond it was nothing but a vast open field, bisected by the border of the Earth Kingdom proper. He could see the lantern glow of the guard stations in the distance. The agents of the Earth King were supposedly on high alert across the continent after His Majesty's most recent rampage in Ba Sing Se. Chiu claimed the walls of the upper ring were painted with all the high-born traitors and spies purged from court in this latest round. Not with their blood, but the people themselves. They managed to throw enough conspirators up on the walls to get nice, even coverage. For a broker who needed to deal in quality information, Chiu believed the dumbest stories. But still, Kavik knew it was bad for your health to get embroiled in a national fray. His work lay completely on the Shang side, and for that he was grateful. He took cover behind a landscaping shed that was probably used for 1 month out of the entire year. When it was clear, he sprinted across the open ground and pressed himself against the correct wall. It gave off a chill he could feel on his exposed face. Unlike its brick and board neighbors, the blue manse was made entirely of ice. Kavik wriggled his nose, trying to brush off the itch of many different annoyances at once. The blue manse was someone's idea of a grand polar residence, but it failed to mimic Agna Kala's architectural traditions. The fancy guest house was too square, too chunky, built without consideration of the natural movements of melt and snowpack. He knew it required the regular employ of waterbenders to reshape and refreeze the walls. Sorry, friends, Kavik thought. At least I'm giving you more work. He shed his parka, folded it neatly, and placed it in a shadow so it would stay dry. Braced by cold and regret, he made a gesture that resembled a swimmer's plunge, melting an alcove into the corner of the building. Kavik stepped inside. A coffin of ice glittered around him. He was a strange bird squeezed inside a strange eggshell. He couldn't afford to make the chamber any larger, or else he'd hatch prematurely into the hallways. Now came the hard part. With small bending motions, he transformed the ice above his head to water and carefully, carefully coaxed it to run down the surface in front of him. Before the drip soaked his feet, he pressed himself upward using the walls to the left and right. Once his legs were in an elevated straddle, he froze the pool underneath him into a solid floor again. 6 inches. The complex series of steps that had taken him weeks of practice had elevated him by about 6 inches. Now he had to do it over and over again until he reached the third floor. An observer might have wondered why he didn't go faster at the expense of getting wet. An observer could shut their trap and go back to the middle of the world, where it was soft and warm. As it stood, if Kavik remained perfectly dry, he had about 30 minutes before death from the cold set in. If freezing water got on him, he might be incapacitated in less than 5. He painstakingly lifted himself higher through the corner of the building, closing the tunnel behind him. Maybe a better waterbender, Kalyan the Great, for example, could have flowed through solid ice unimpeded. Kavik the Lesser had to squiggle his way through, and was going to need healing for frostbitten hands once he was done. The walls of the blue manse were intentionally opaque for privacy, but they weren't perfect cover. While the corners offered the thickest ice for hiding in, someone passing close by might notice his presence. He could hear voices congregated toward the center of the ground floor. Some kind of large gathering, Chu said, would serve as a distraction. It worked well enough. No one wandered over to his corner, and Kavik ascended through the first story without any problems. He paused for breath, crouching in the thick layer of ice that made up the first ceiling and the second floor, and thinned a portion of the ice to peek at the next stage. There were people in the outer hallways this time. With the darkness of night behind him and the light of oil lamps inside, he had a slight vision advantage. He could see about 4 or 5 blurs standing completely still, not talking. Were they waiting in line for something? Suddenly, a pair split off, tromping in sync down the hall, neither outpacing the other. Kavik would have banged his head against his tiny chamber had he not been afraid of breaking through it. Those weren't idle guests. Those were patrols. Chew, you bleeding hog monkey. Kavik had been told the job was a light grab from a visiting bureaucrat, and there wouldn't be any formal security. Now he was stuck between sky and earth, freezing his tailbone off inches away from real soldiers and not goons for pay like Tayin's. He had to wait until they were gone before he could move. And he had to pick a direction. Up, and take the biggest risk he ever had as a runner. Down, and lose the lead he'd been working on for months. Kavik was forced to burn more of his body's time limit just sitting there, counting off the guard rotations for a window to move. His teeth began to chatter. Hard. When the next pair leaves, not this pair. The next one. As soon as their backs turned, he resumed his climb. By his best guess, he now had to move twice as fast as he was prepared to. Cold trickles ran down the back of his neck. Sweat would have been bad enough, but this was runoff from the ice above. The freezing water made him want to scream. He had no choice but to endure it. The guards would be on the return leg now, and he was only a third of the way up. He hurried and got wetter for his troubles. To make things worse, the glow of a hand lamp rounded the bend, someone he hadn't accounted for. A servant fetching a drink or a snack. The thought of being nabbed for such a stupid reason was too much to bear. Kavik scrabbled upward, throwing caution to the wind in the exact manner he promised himself he wouldn't. By the time the lamp holder passed beneath him, he was tucked away inside the ice between the second and third floor, his knees pressed to his chin, drenched. He might as well have plunged headfirst into a turtle seal's breathing hole. There wasn't enough space to dry himself with full-armed water bending. In less than a minute, his muscles would stop moving, and then any sort of death would be free to take him. Proper freezing, suffocation. The floor under him could give out, and he'd fall 3 stories. He needed to get warm and dry immediately, and the nearest place he could was the room he was trying to break into. There was no other choice. If the occupants were still inside, he'd throw himself upon their mercy because the cold didn't give a lick. With a burst of desperation, Kavik brought his hands up and melted a small portal. He squirmed through and flopped onto the third floor like a landed fish, gasping for breath. The first thing he did was whip the water off himself like it was a cloud of mosquito leeches. He spotted a large oil lamp across the room and pushed himself over to it with his heels, hoping he could get close enough before he blacked out. Kavik had no other concern but the heat. At this point, if he got caught, he got caught. But in the first bit of luck he'd had all night, no one interrupted his crawl for survival. The room was empty. Fate allowed the giant soapstone lamp to do its work, and blood slowly returned to Kavik's extremities. Once he had the strength to raise his head, he looked around. He was in the poshest quarters of the Blue Manse. That much was obvious. Rich wooden furniture harvested and shaped from continental trees. Walls insulated with foreign wool rugs. Decorative plants that surely would have perished the instant they left the sanctuary of this floor. No furs, though, strangely enough. Not a single scrap, when desirable hides and skins were one of the staple commodities of Bin Ur. A desk, topped with a giant slab of polished obsidian, drew his eye. It held a messy pile of books and scrolls, stacks of correspondence. That was what Chiu had sent him for. Information. More valuable than gold in Bin Ur, if it came from the right people, and the magnificence of the room indicated the occupant was definitely the right sort of people. Kavik got up and wobbled over to the desk, planting a hand on it for support. His orders were to make his way into this room and memorize anything that looked important. But his brain was barely working, and there was so much potential treasure here. The right document could be worth 100 times its neighbors. Might as well start with the ones being used. A large scroll had been spread out, its corners weighed down by books. A building plan of some sort. He couldn't read the notes, so he carefully removed the weights, noting how they lay so he could replace them, and held the paper up to the light. The door opened. He lowered the scroll. A girl, about 16 or 17 like him, walked in with her eyes closed. She wore several layers of orange and yellow robes, and a damp towel hung around her shoulders. She flapped her hand at her face, and the motion caused her long black hair to stream behind her, blown by an unseen wind. There was a small cut along her forehead, higher than her hairline would have normally been. The redness stood out on the wide blue arrow tattooed onto her scalp. Nicked herself shaving, Kavik thought. An air nomad. Why would an air nomad be staying in the Blue Manse, which was normally reserved for... Oh no. Oh no. The girl opened her eyes. They widened a little when she saw Kavik, but not by much. She stopped drying her hair and looked at the scroll in his hands. Please don't take that, she said.
I haven't finished studying it.
Kavik swallowed. If he could open his mouth to speak, he might pray to the moon and ocean that this wasn't actually happening, and he was imagining it all in his head. But the one human being who could intercede on his behalf with the spirits was the very person he'd burgled. She could swat down his pleas, leaving him a luckless, forsaken husk. He handed the scroll back. He could do nothing else.
Thank you, Avatar Yang Chen said as she took the paper from him. You might want to cover your ears now. I've been told I can scream pretty loud.
Flight. Spirits above, she wasn't kidding. The Avatar's air-bending-powered cry hurt Kavik's ears through his palms and snuffed the oil lamp's wick out. The force of her lungs hit him in waves, like the roar of a tiger dillo. A pair of guards came running down the hallway and blocked the exit.
Intruder!
They bellowed once they spotted Kavik.
Intruder in the Avatar's room!
One of them raised his fist. Firebender. Kavik didn't think. On instinct, he grabbed the nearest cover and ducked behind it. To everyone's great shock, including his own, that was the Avatar herself.
Swine! The firebender was hoarse with fury. How dare you!
Hey, no one felt worse about it than him. Using the holiest figure in the world like a plank shield was not his proudest moment. He turned her so she faced her guards and stayed low, clinging to her waist like a shipwreck survivor to driftwood. Through the side of his face pressed to her back, he felt a shake, Was she laughing? Be careful, she said to her guards. He's a waterbender. That's right, he was a waterbender. And they were inside a house of ice. One wrong move and he could send deadly shards hurtling into her flesh from all directions. If he were a total monster. The guards hesitated. And that was enough. The Avatar's warning helped Kavik more than anything. He let go of her and stepped back to create some space, jostling the table behind him. A pile of envelopes scattered like fallen leaves.
What are the chances we can forget this ever happened? Kavik said to the room, genuinely asking.
Dead silence.
No? All right, then.
With a flourish, he leaned back and splashed through the floor. The plan was to ignore the cold for now and break his fall with a liquefied section of the blue manse, plunge to the ground level, and then run out the front door. For the halfest of seconds, he was a genius. A squad of guards barreling up the stairs to protect the Avatar didn't notice the boy dropping behind them. He reached for the ice that made up the first floor ceiling and melted it enough to avoid an unpleasant impact, squeezing through the makeshift portal, and then he got stuck. The water had solidified around one of his ankles, nearly tearing his hip out of its socket. And now, he dangled upside down in a reception area, full of tables laden with fine food. The party was abandoned, the very important guests having fled when the Avatar screamed, no doubt. The only people who remained were two Water Tribe guards who approached Kavik cautiously, one of them wearing a water skin over his shoulder so he wouldn't have to ruin the architecture like the intruder had. He must have been the waterbender who'd trapped Kavik like a side of meat hanging in a smokehouse.
Brothers? Kavik tried.
The non-bender hefted a ball club. His partner flicked the cap off his water skin.
Okay, reasonable.
Kavik flung his arms around, freezing the water inside the pouch. The act would buy him an extra moment as the man struggled in confusion to get his element out of its container. Fire was always fire, and rocks were rocks, but waterbending had the extra snag of managing the change from solid to liquid and back again. While the bender was distracted, Kavik pulled himself toward his ankle and freed his leg, just in time to avoid the club and fall on the off-balance man who swung it. He clung tight to the guard's parka, planted his feet in the man's hip bones, and rolled them over to put his opponent on top so he could take the brunt of the water blast the bender finally managed to get out. The blow was hard enough to knock the man unconscious. These guys were out for blood. Kavik flung the limp guard off him and spun on his back, not bothering to rise, and kicked a strip of water off the wall, connecting his foot to the other bender's. A yank took the second man down. The closer to the ground they stayed, the more they flopped around, the better. Kavik was only average at the push and pull of traditional elemental combat, but no one had beaten him at wrestling in years. Bending gave him more limbs to work with. Kavik dodged the water whip that sliced down at his head and froze it to the floor, turning the liquid into ice all the way back up the other bender's arm, pinning him in place. Now was his chance to get away. He scrambled to his feet and leaped out the door. But before his foot touched down, he was sucked back into the jaws of the blue manse by an unseen force tugging on his shirt from behind, slurped up like a noodle in soup. He'd taken too long. The waterbender must have freed himself faster than expected and reconnected them. Kavik landed in the welcoming embrace of four more guards. It was over. They dogpiled him, twisting his arms behind his back. Through the muffling of their furs, he heard the Avatar's voice. "Don't hurt the boy," she ordered. "Take him to the basement and make sure he's unharmed. I wish to speak with him in a few minutes." The full weight of his crimes sunk in as they hauled Kavik away. This wasn't just a bad run. He wasn't just going to the magistrate's cells. This was the Avatar he'd crossed. What kind of punishment did you get for that? forgiveness. It turned out Kavik's punishment was pretty basic. It started with a regular old beating.
Street scum!
A boot landed square in his stomach as he lay curled up on the basement floor. He wrapped himself tighter around the ball of pain in his gut.
How dare you defile the chambers of the Avatar, laying your filthy hands on her?
Kavik noticed the trimming on the guard's clothes as they kicked him. Red, green, blue. At least hurting him was a multinational effort. He tried to explain with the little remaining air he had left.
I didn't mean to...
Shut up!
A fist cracked him across the jaw. Blood spilled into his mouth. Kavik buried his face back into his elbows, but no more blows came.
Stand him up, said the leader. She's coming.
They hoisted him to his feet while he was still in a daze. He heard footsteps coming down the stairs. A swishing hem, a clatter of beads. Once his vision unblurred, the Avatar stood before him in her full regalia. A bloom of yellow and orange, dappled with wooden medallions. She was startlingly pretty. Against the frosted basement walls, her serene features and deep gray eyes stood out like artwork. He caught himself and quickly banished the thought from his head. This was the Avatar. She noticed the small trickle of blood leaking from the corner of Kavik's mouth.
Captain Guy, she said to the leader of her guards.
Yes, mistress?
You're fired.
The bluntness of her statement caused it to bounce off Kavik's ears. Guy needed a moment, too.
I'm sorry, he said.
The Avatar turned to him.
You and your men are all fired. I told you not to hurt him, and you did. What's not to understand?
But...
None of you are eligible for employment for security in the Avatar's retinue anymore.
Her voice never rose above a conversational level, and yet the men wilted as if she were spouting dragon's breath.
Report to Boma and tell him what you did so he can strike your names from the lists. Now.
Kavik had never seen so many grown men hang their heads like children. They shuffled back up the stairs, leaving him alone with the Avatar. She took a step closer. He threw himself at her feet, pressing his forehead to the cold floor.
I'm sorry, he wailed. I'm so sorry. I didn't know.
Shh, shh, it's all right. She knelt down and raised his head. Through his tears, he saw her bend some clean water from a basin. The pulsing liquid shone when she pressed it to his face. The swelling subsided, and he could feel the gash on the inside of his mouth seal itself.
Hands now, she said, before they fall off.
She'd noted the early stages of frostbite. Kavik held out his hands. The Avatar layered his fingers between hers, the gesture uncomfortably intimate, and this time the glow was warm. Feeling returned to his skin. Fixing damage from the cold was a lengthy, specific process, and he wondered how she came by the knowledge.
Are you hurt anywhere else? She asked. What about your body?
He shook his head. His stomach was bruised, but his ribs were still intact.
I'm fine.
She looked like she doubted that very much.
You picked the wrong stage in the Avatar cycle to rob. Air nomads don't have much in the way of possessions.
He owed her the truth.
I didn't know it was the Avatar's room, and I wasn't after valuables. I wanted information I could sell.
Ah.
She raised her eyebrows. Her interest piqued.
You must be one of those errand runners Bin Ur is so famous for. I was warned before coming here that I'd be entering a city of spies.
So she'd heard. In the Shang territories, Information intelligence was by far the most desirable currency. Fortunes traveled on paper. Deals in the making, contracts, meeting notes, even sharply worded letters could herald business opportunities with unlimited potential upside for anyone in the know. Sometimes there was only a verbal agreement tying obscene sums of money together, in which case you needed a person listening in the right place at the right time. The Avatar sighed and shook her head.
Everyone you meet in Bin Ur is in someone else's pocket, or so I've heard the saying go. Which Shang do you work for?
None, Kavik said. I'm independent. I'm just trying to survive day to day.
Supporting a family?
No. His voice cracked. I came to Bin Ur by myself after my parents died. I thought there'd be steady work, but I couldn't find any. I've got nothing to my name.
You're alone.
She stared into the distance, as if she were mulling over a strange scent, before returning to him.
I'm sorry. I've never really been alone. Not ever. I can't imagine what it's been like for you.
It's hard in the city.
He sniffed and wiped his nose.
Touts for work crews come to your village and tell stories about how the streets of Bin Ur are paved in gold, and anyone who's clever enough can become a great merchant as long as they work hard, he said. Then you get here and find out the harsh truth. You're not worth anything until someone else decides you are.
The lamplight flickered, and he thought he saw a flash of anger, approaching hatred, ripple across her face. But he must have imagined it. Her expression of air nomad grace was all the stronger for the troubled twist of her lips.
I'm hoping I can change such attitudes before they become permanent. Let a problem last for too long, and people begin to believe it's not a problem.
She chewed on her cheek.
Maybe I can start with you. You only run errands for the money, right?
Kavik shrugged.
Why else would anyone get into this line of business?
Well, that settles it.
She reached into her wide sleeve and pulled out a large purse.
If you had some silver weighing you down, maybe you'd be less keen a burglar.
Wait.
Somewhere along the line, they'd skipped a few steps.
I don't understand.
She thought he was confused about why she had money to begin with.
Diplomatic expense budget, she explained.
That's not it.
Why would she be loading his pockets before sending him to face his punishment? Unless...
You're gonna let me go?
Kavik asked.
What do you want me to do? Throw you in Air Temple jail? Trust me, this is a matter of convenience. I don't have to deal with the work you'd create otherwise, and you'd get to stay off the streets for however long this gift lasts.
She loosened the drawstrings. He couldn't believe it. His eyes and ears deceived him.
Wait,
Kavik sputtered, remembering various bits of spiritual regulations he wasn't even sure were correct.
An air avatar shouldn't touch money.
She rolled her eyes, and for his sake more than hers, widened the mouth of the bag without touching the contents. Holding it like a pitcher, she poured a stream of coins into his hands. He watched the flow of generosity, a miracle in a city as mercenary as Bin Ur. When she was done, she gestured at the wall behind him.
There's an exit that leads out the side. Get out of here while you have the chance, and don't let anyone see you.
Air nomads really were different in spirit. Kavik put the coins in his pockets and pushed open the iced-over door. He climbed the cramped stairs, disbelieving each step he took. In defiance of how his night had gone, they led to the street and freedom. No one accosted him. It was as if the Avatar's blessing lingered over his skin like armor. He went around the building and picked up his parka. Once he was fully dressed, he joined the remaining stragglers in the International District. What just happened? He thought, looking up at the starry sky. He would never be able to explain it. Not in this era or the next. Kavik walked for a couple more blocks, and then took a sudden right, using a big man as a screen so anyone following him from behind wouldn't see his change in direction until it was too late. Sprinting down the alley, he opened a door he knew was unlocked, and left it slightly ajar to make it look like he'd gone inside when he hadn't. His real path was the brick wall covered in a thick layer of ice from a leaky drain pipe. With a pull of waterbending, he shaped handholds that let him cross to the other side with ease, and then broke the ice. It fell to the ground and shattered, looking like a victim of its own weight. He took another right, then a left, and a right again. Only when he was sure he hadn't been tailed did he walk around the block to the entrance of a dimly lit hall. He knocked on the door normally, without any pattern. It swung open. A gray-haired water tribe woman peered up at Kavik.
"Well, you look smitten," Mama Ayunarok said. "I haven't seen that dopey grin since Mehua dumped you."
Narrowly getting away with one's life could do that to a man. Kavik looked over her shoulder inside. The shelter was packed tonight, benches and tables full of men and women tucking into bowls of sea root porridge. Ayunarok ran a kitchen for workers caught without work, mostly newcomers who relied on the free meals she provided. The city might have doubled in size while she'd lived there, but the old woman wasn't going to let the customs of Water Tribe hospitality be forgotten. Food was meant to be shared with anyone who needed it.
"I have something for you," Kavik said.
He produced a fistful of coins, the first of several. Ayunarok's mouth fell open in shock.
Where did you?
Don't ask.
He scooped the money out of his pockets into her hands, trying not to drop any. He should have asked the Avatar for the bag itself. She was nice enough to have given it to him.
"It's been a while since you visited your cousins in Port Tugak, right?" Kavik said. "Take some of that money and go see them. Do it for all us saps who don't have travel rights."
He gave the stunned woman a quick nuzzle on the cheek.
"I wasn't here."
Ayunarok was too dumbfounded to shout at him as he ran back around the corner. Near her kitchen's refuse trough, close to the ground and covered by rotting cabbage leaves, was a loose brick, and hidden behind that was a key. Without further incident, he reached Bin Ur's Water Tribe quarter. Its dwellings were fitted to the seasons, and right now built with panes of wind-blown snow. Made of winter to withstand winter. When it got warmer in the summer, the residents would switch over to sod houses and tents as necessary. Looking at the white domes, Kavik scrunched his upper lip in a burst of fresh irritation at the square ice of the blue manse. He could easily imagine it having been built for Midler dignitaries who merely wanted the novelty of sleeping under frozen water. But what right did he have to criticize? Nearby was one of the largest homes in the neighborhood. A creaky stalwart of old Bin Ur that looked like it belonged in Omashu. He walked up the hard dirt path, shook the snow from his boots, and used his key to unlock the door. Warm, steamy air bathed his face. "I'm home," he called out. Inside, a woman looked up from the pot of stew she was stirring. His mother brushed a loop of hair out of her face and gave him a smile. "You're back late. How was your day?"
"Was okay. Almost died, met the Avatar, stole from her."
He wedged his boot off and retrieved the folded envelope he'd managed to grab from her room before he'd plunged through her floor. Taking items themselves wasn't as good as leaving them undisturbed. The Avatar would realize one of her letters was missing. And then it would be off to an endless cycle of her knowing someone else knew what she knew. The information game often devolved into such never-ending spirals, a spider snake swallowing its own tail. But the envelope was still worth something for merely having passed through her hands. He had to decide whether to break the seal. The value could be higher with an aura of mystery around it. He tucked it under his shirt for later.
"Be careful passing through the square tomorrow,"
he said to the man sitting behind a desk in the corner.
"There was trouble earlier."
His father barely looked up from the ledgers he'd brought home from the counting house. A grunt came back in response. More acknowledgement than Kavik got on most nights. He hung his parka up. Without the extra layers, he could hear his stomach rumble. Despite the bruise he knew was growing on his stomach, he was hungry.
"What's for dinner?"
he asked his family.